Viscount Allenby, Reel 2. Viscount, may I ask you just one or two questions about Bovington when the Hussars were mechanised in 28, 29? You were separated in this house. Did you have much to do socially with the tank corps?
Oh, yes, of course we did. Of course we did. And we got on very well with them. But I don't think in those days, I don't think there would have been room for us in the tank corps mess. It wasn't as big as all that. And, they're very, very good social relations. And, of course, we had a marvellous time because it really was a lovely house. It was right on the moors. It had two or three drives, about 2 or 3 miles long. The trout stream in which you could catch a salmon at the bottom of the garden. Luxury.
And did you have much time for riding?
I was there in the summer months, yes, plenty of time, of course. In fact, I think we really only had that house for roughly the summer months. No, plenty of time. Then we'd always get up early in the morning before instruction started and ride, and you had the whole of the evening when it was light up till 9, 10 o'clock.
And what did you think of the tank corps for the first time you've come into contact with them?
Oh, very pleasant. Very pleasant indeed. And very, very helpful.
What sort of place was Bovington at that time? Was it a large establishment?
Oh, I don't know what that was there. Well, it was the tank corps depot, of course. It was mostly hutted accommodation. Wooden huts, it was, as far as I can remember. I went there later on. I remember more about it then, just before the Second War started.
When you went to Egypt with the regiment, what was your job out there?
Very largely training. You were always there. You kept there for use in the event of anything strange blowing up, which did occasionally. If you remember, 1936, I think, when the Italians got a bit muddled up in Abyssinia and one thing or another, and they strengthened their forces in Libya. Well, our job then was to go out and just keep an eye on them. On rather a wide front, they'd built the most enormous wire fence right away down from the sea. And had to keep an eye on them. And then in 1936, I think it was before that. No, it was about the same year, of course. The Jews and the Arabs were causing a good deal of trouble in Palestine, shooting at each other and one thing or another. And that was almost all sort of convoy protection, because it wasn't really very safe to go. For some time, it wasn't very safe to go up and down the roads there. And we were just doing convoys the whole time.
You were in armoured cars?
Yeah.
What kind of armoured cars were you in?
We were still in the Rolls-Royce armoured cars. Wonderful machines they were, too.
And how effective were they for this job of protecting?
Oh, very, I think. I think only by the presence. I mean, I can't remember very often. Somebody used to fire a shot occasionally, but nothing very much happened. I think provided anybody travelling by car was protected by a convoy of armoured cars, the Arabs, whoever they were, they didn't bother to shoot it. They'd stick a few mines and things every now and then on the path, but they weren't very efficient mines anyhow. You could usually see where they were anyway.
How many sort of armoured cars would there be to a convoy? How did it sort of work in practice?
Well, it depends on the size of the convoy, of course, but I think normally if it was a few lorries or something going through, just a troop of armoured cars, it's all three.
How would you keep in touch with each other? Did you have wireless?
I think, yes, we must have had wireless by then, yes. Not very efficient, but good enough to get from one end of the troop to the other anyway.
And mechanically, the Rolls-Royce, how did they work out?
Oh, they were superb. Quite fantastic. Because some of them, I remember one was a 1908 model. Just went like a bomb, too. They were mystically number eight. But the oldest one was 1908, I think. And then most of them, I think they were built in the First World War, between about 1914 and 1920, most of them. Still went beautifully.
Did you have any problems with them in terms of desert?
No, I didn't have problems with them, I don't think. But, of course, it takes a long time to train a driver to drive through desert sand and to recognize the bits of sand that are completely soft. And I think the training that we did in Egypt in 1936, stood the regiment. I wasn't with them actually at the outbreak of war, but stood them in very, very good stead, because they really, by the time the war had started, 1939, they really knew, like nobody else, how to get across the desert and how to find your way, for one thing. The maps were absolutely nothing. They were just blank sheets of paper. Right? Every now and then something was described as white rock or something.
Was there any particular mechanical problem that you had with the Rolls Royce?
No, I don't think so, no, because, I mean, for most engines, one of the problems was sand getting in. And they ran tests, I remember, early on in the war, and there was less sand got into the cylinders of those old Rolls Royces than there was any other vehicle, including the RAF Rolls-Royce aero engines, much more modern ones.
You mentioned earlier on training. What sort of training were you doing?
It was very largely... what did we do? I can't remember. It was very... We used to do... exercises with other arms, of course, with infantry, tanks, and artillery, of course. Very much in anticipation, I suppose, and useful training too, I think, as to very like the battles as they did turn out in the war in Libya and so on.
What was the tank role in those exercises? What was the cavalry role, your role?
Reconnaissance again, almost completely. Reconnaissance. Of course, there was a good many, if you remember, the war, I mean, we had continual advances away westward, and continually been driven back again. To a certain extent, a rearguard action too. They had to be fought by the armored cars, but mainly reconnaissance going forward, usually many, many miles away ahead of the main forces.
On the training program, did you find the armoured car very effective? How did it compare with a horse? Were there major differences?
Oh, I think really in desert warfare it's a great deal more suitable. Maybe a camel would be better if you'd ride one, but there's a great difference with horses in the desert, particularly water, of course.
How did you go about it in reconnaissance work? How far did you go ahead, and how did you report back and things? How was this done?
Well, it all depended, really, depend on the situation. I mean, sometimes going a little bit further on to the actual war, we say after the Battle of Alamein. After the Battle of Alamein, for example, The armoured car regiments were generally 40, 50, 60 miles ahead of anybody else, you know. On the other hand, if they were in a defensive position and maybe the enemy was advancing towards them, they would be they're in close touch with the other side. I mean, for ages, Dalamin, for example, the armoured car regiments just sat and watched and watched and watched about 4 or 5 miles perhaps out ahead of the infantry posts.
On these training exercises, did you work with tanks much? With the tank corps?
Not particularly, I don't think. Again, because of the difference in our roles, you see. You wouldn't have worked terribly closely with them, no closer with them than perhaps with the infantry and artillery and so on and so forth. You know.
What were some of the objectives that were set in those training programmes? What were you sort of aiming at, the overall exercise?
Well, it was just some exercise of a force advancing from A with the object of blowing an ammunition dump up at B or something like that. It was quite easy for force at, for both forces to be planned, A to go to B and B to go to A, and they never see each other at all in the desert. Because certainly in the pre-war days, with practically non-existent maps, you could easily think you were somewhere where you weren't.
Did that actually happen?
It did happen in one exercise. I remember distinctly two fairly large forces of about brigade strength of attached troops. They'd all been planned carefully that they were, B was to go to A and A was to go to B, and they were bound to meet, but they didn't at all.
How did you manage about fuel and things when you were on this sort of reconnaissance rail? Did you have fuel dumps and things?
No, you were supposed to carry it all, but unfortunately, I remember the first reconnaissance we ever did, which was merely a reconnaissance to merely an exercise, just one squadron. It happened to be my squadron. Really, an exercise in desert navigation. I mean, we went about 200 miles to an oasis. Because that took quite a lot of learning how to navigate, particularly on maps that had no features on them at all. And that really was the object of the exercise. 11 Hussars, that said, I wasn't with them in the war, but they became absolute experts at desert navigation, and they were used a lot to teach other units in this very, very tricky business of navigating in the desert. I was lucky, of course. I had been with them a little bit, and when I went out there, I was commanding a yeomanry regiment. And I was very lucky to have had this opportunity in navigation, because it was quite incredible how people can get totally lost and how they can... you know, they only go a few miles from the bivouac area, what it is, and turn around and come back and miss it altogether, unless they are fairly skilled in navigation.
Would you say that was your principal problem then during these exercises and during this?
I remember it was on this very first exercise we did. But you see, the whole. I remember we ran out of petrol. What else? You talked about fuel, by the way, and didn't you? Unfortunately, in those days, petrol was in sort of tins, sort of square. I think they were about 4 gallon tins, a very, very light tinning. And they bumped up and down the lorries going over the desert, and half the petrol ran out of the bottom, which was another thing we had to learn, because we thought we'd got plenty of petrol. Of course, we hadn't. And I remember so well the adjutant being called up on the wireless saying we wanted the extra petrol to convoy, you know. What are you worrying about? You're coming back from, it was an oasis called Barrea, actually. You're coming back from Barrea, he's going to Barrea, you're bound to meet. The chances of your meeting were very, very remote, unless you arranged a lot of signals for lights and so on and so forth.
And on that particular one, did you run out of petrol, or?
Yes, we did run out of petrol, actually. I think we had some petrol brought to us by the Air Force. And
so you were working actually with the air as well, were you? At
that time? Oh, very much, yes. Oh. Well, always. I think that was a very important part of our training, and proved very important too in the actual war, at cooperation with the Air Force. But the whole thing was rather confusing. The Air Force always said we were shooting down their planes, and we always said they were dropping bombs on us. But
how did this work in your training program? Did you have air contact then with the Air
Force? Oh,
yes, at the
time? Yes. Yeah, definitely.
Did you in your individual cars, or how did this work?
Well, it depends what... normally, the whole of an armoured car regiment would be out on this reconnaissance, and the Air Force could be, I didn't say it always was, on the same net as the regimental commander, or alternatively directly back to brigade, who were, of course, netted to their own armoured car regiment. And the Air Force would spot something and perhaps wouldn't be able to identify it. Maybe they couldn't fly over it or something, couldn't fly low over it or something like that because of anti-aircraft fire. And the armoured car people would be told to go and have a look and see what it was.
When you were out on those exercises and you'd spotted something or other, when you were reporting back, what kind of signalling system was developed? Was there any wireless system?
No, wireless, yes. Good wireless at the... I think I'm wrong. I think earlier on I said that the wireless was not very good in 34, 35, 36. That's before the war. I think it wasn't too bad. It hadn't got a very, very great range, the set in the cars. But on the whole, it was very good. And it was very good later on when war did break out.
But you'd say then that these exercises that you did were very effective in training cavalry in
armoured cars. Oh, very, I think, yes, very.
When you broke down and things in the desert, how did you go about sorting that problem out?
Well, you got an ordnance. It was ordnance in those days, I think. Yes, part of the ordnance corps did all the maintenance. Not now the Remy who do it all, but you had what was called a light aid detachment of ordnance people within the regiment, and they could do pretty well anything that was required. It was slightly different in wartime. I'm talking about training time, when you didn't want to abandon the thing and leave it there. In wartime, you very often had to abandon the thing and just leave it, and it would be picked up by somebody else later on.
But in these exercises, you...
These exercises, of course, they all had to be rescued. I mean, you couldn't leave them lying about.
Was there many breakdowns in that sort of sense?
I think because they were marvellous machines, those Rolls Royces, they didn't break down, really. And nor did the lorries and supply vehicles. Yeah, but they were jolly good on the whole.
When you mentioned your map work earlier on, were you in the process then of filling in maps? Were you sort of having a blank map, and when you went on an exercise, you came back and put in things that had happened?
No, because it probably would have been wrong if you had. I think they were so blank, those maps. Yeah, I'm talking about the training period before the war. When war started, there were much better maps that had been produced. I don't know who did them, but I think they must have been done in anticipation of a desert war.
When you were out in Cairo and places, did you meet socially the tank corps? Did you come into contact sort of?
Oh, yes, indeed.
And were there any sort of joint meetings and things to discuss mechanisation or
anything? No, like I don't think so. No, I don't remember anything like that at all.
Did you keep your horses? Did you take horses with you?
To Egypt? Oh, now you get me. Were we allowed chargers? Did we get any horses fed? I can't remember. I think, yes. Still, I think when we went, I realized in 1934, I'm pretty sure it was 34, yes, it was, and I believe we were still allowed the privilege of having two horses fed by a gracious government. I think that still went on.
When you left Egypt, why were you sent to Bovington?
When I left for Egypt?
When you came back to England?
Well, because it was at that time that the whole of the mechanization of the cavalry was starting. Would it have been 1936, 1937 or something like that? And the cavalry regiments were starting just in the same way as we had, doing their courses at Bovington to learn how machines worked. And then Inspector General of Cavalry asked me if I would go there, and he said that, instead of the War Office, when I came back from Egypt, he said they wanted peaceful, happy relations with the Royal Tankard and Regiment, who I don't think were too happy. I mean, they got terribly overcrowded by then, because typical in the army, nothing was really quite ready. I mean, there just wasn't room in the officers' mess, but they, you know, all these cavalry soldiers had to be in the tank corps mess while they were busy building another one. You know, they hadn't sort of thought in advance about that sort of thing. So relations could have become rather strained, maybe. And my sole job, I was told, was to keep everybody happy, which I tried to do.
But the Inspector General of Cavalry did expect some sort of trouble, did he?
No, I don't think so. But obviously the wonderful treatment that we in the 11th Hussars had with this nice house that was rented for us, this could not possibly be extended to anything like the virtue of the whole of the British cavalry who were then being mechanized, you know. Now, you see, Bovington was very much the home of the tank corps. It was their home. It was rather like an invasion of their privacy, I think.
This inspector, did he make any comments about what he thought of the mechanization of the cavalry regiments?
Oh, no, because it was then accepted. I mean, it had got to be, you know. And, of course, it got to be done jolly quickly because it didn't start till, I've forgotten what year, they ought to know, 36 or 37, when the National War broke out in 39.
Do you think he expected any resistance from the cavalry regiments? Did he?
Well, he wanted to make sure that mechanization was accepted. And in the same spirit as it had been with by the 11th Hussars and the 12th Lancers, was the only way to make a success of it. After all, time wasn't on their side. They had very, very little time to become trained before war broke out.
What was your job when you went down to Bovington? I know you had this...
Oh, well, officially I was called adjutant of the D&M wing, driving and maintenance wing. But mainly to keep the peace, see that everybody was happy.
Now, when you went down there, the cavalry regiments were already beginning to arrive.
Yeah.
How did the atmosphere compare then with what you had experienced when you were with the 11th Hussars?
Well, I think one of the difficulties was there was rather, or it might have been a difficulty, it wasn't. There was rather a different, the start off, all tank corps young officers were trained at Bovington. And they were trained perhaps in their behavior and their social contact and so on and so forth in the mess. It was rather different to what was common in most cavalry regiments. In the cavalry regiment, the officer's mess, as far as the officers were concerned, was very much his home. And he did what he's like. He came in with his coat unbuttoned and his yellow waistcoat, or he shoved his coat over a chair, and that sort of thing. That wasn't allowed at the Tank Corps. It wasn't a good thing. And one of the difficulties was to allow the cavalry officers who were being trained as much latitude as possible in sort of to get them to feel that the mess was there without upsetting the Tank Corps senior officers, who had a little bit different way they expected rather different customs, should I say, than the cavalry officers were used to. And the officers, they weren't allowed to have any button undone at all in their tunic in the mess. They were rather on parade the whole time, if you see what I mean. Not critical, they were just two different ways. And I used to be on the mat fairly often, you know, the Tank Corps commanding officer. Officers with yellow waistcoats on under their tunics and showing at the bottom wasn't allowed, wasn't right.
And the senior Tank Corps people would complain to you, would they?
Oh, well, yes, the colonel would always complain to me about anything was going wrong, and we try and catch people to cover up the yellow waistcoats. You know, it's very simple. There was no difficulty at all, really.
Were there any specific incidents where this sort of happened?
No, nothing of note, really. Nothing at all. But then eventually, I can't remember how long, after about a year, 6 months or a year or something like that, the AFE school had its own mess and own sounds mess and everything else. And the cavalry people were then in a separate mess from the Tank Corps depot mess, you see.
Was this feeling, this attitude in the mess, was it partly a class thing at all? Was there a difference in social...
No, there is a war. I don't know whether there is now. There was always a funny sort of thing, you know. Sorts of relationship. You know, even gunners. I mean, cavalry people used to say, oh, so strange people gunners, aren't they? You know, or strange people Royal Engineers. This is just a sort of way of talking. Royal Engineers and the gunners probably thought a strange thing the other way on, you know. Just went like that. You know. Didn't matter, it's quite a good thing, really. We're all greatest friends, anyway.
Would you say that the attitude to work in the Tank Corps was different to the attitude in the cavalry?
Only in...